two things this morning. The first is going to be finishing off the Hebrew history that we started the last couple of weeks, at least the broad overview of Hebrew history, and then whenever we get a chance to go back and do verse by verse through Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus and all that stuff, then we'll fill in all the blanks. But what I'm trying to do right now, as you recall, is this is just to get that big overview of the importance of circumcision and the covenants, particularly the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant, in how they're going to play into Paul's theology in the book of Romans. So that's why I'm skipping over big chunks of important stuff, because I'm trying to just concentrate on the central theme of, number one, circumcision, which is mentioned all through the New Testament. So that's why I'm trying to get you that circumcision overview. And then general Hebrew history that all these folks would have known when they got Paul's letter. The Gentiles who received the Roman letter got plenty of it that told them that they were sinners before God, though they didn't have the law. And then the Hebrews who got the letter of Romans were told that they were also sinners because they had the law. And this argument that he's about to continue in chapter 2 isn't going to make much sense to us unless we have this broad overview of how these covenants play into each other. Today I hope to get into the law covenant and show you the difference between the Abrahamic and law covenant. Not all the differences, because there's a zillion differences between the two, but just in a very broad overview, the primary difference between the two. So let's first finish off the Hebrew history. Where we left off last time, go to Genesis 49. We'll go there. I think that's where we left off last time. Yeah, it is. We've been showing how God gave to Abraham, gave him a specific covenant. There were specific attributes of that covenant. It was not a conditional covenant. And then we saw how it was handed down to particular sons. And it was always the youngest son that got the covenant, while the oldest, who should have gotten the birthright, was passed over. The particular Abrahamic covenant that became known as the Abrahamic birthright, or the birthright promise, was passed on to Abraham's younger son. Ishmael was passed over in favor of, anybody remember? Isaac, exactly. Isaac had two boys, twin boys, Jacob and Esau. Who got it? Jacob got it. Esau was passed over. Jacob had his name changed to Israel. We saw that last week. He had 12 kids. Who ended up with the covenant?
Ephraim.
Ephraim ended up with it. Exactly right. He brought his two sons in last week. The two boys were there. He said, I'm going to use these two boys, keep these two boys, take these two boys to myself as though they were my own sons. He reached out to give them the blessing. He crossed his hands and gave it to the younger son, Ephraim. I'm going to show you this week, in fact, right now, that Ephraim specifically, of all the 12 tribes, Ephraim specifically ended up with the birthright promise. All that stuff that is in the Abrahamic covenant, that he would rule the gates of his enemies, that they would inherit the land of Canaan, that God would be their God and he would be their people and he would never leave them, the everlasting kingdom promises, all that stuff went down to Ephraim. That's important because unless you can find a fulfillment of those promises in Ephraim specifically, you haven't found the fulfillment of the promise yet. So historically, those promises haven't been fulfilled yet. Now, in 1948, there was a great migration of Jews back to Israel. And once again, Israel was established as a nation. When Israel was established as a nation, it was the descendants of Judah, the Jews, those who were still keeping the law, those who were still keeping the Mosaic covenant, who came back and established Israel. It's great that Israel was reestablished. That had to happen historically. But that is not the ingathering of all the Israelites back to the land of Canaan that's promised again and again and again and again throughout the Old Testament. Because specifically, every time it's spoken of in the Old Testament, it's that Israel and Judah would be joined together and brought back to Canaan. What you see right now is Judah being brought back, but you haven't seen Israel yet. I'm going to tell you what those definitive terms are today, and you'll understand all that too. Let's start with this blessing, chapter 49. Jacob called his sons. This is Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. He's got 12 boys, plus he's got the two grandsons. He said, gather yourselves together, and I'll tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Gather yourselves together and hear, ye sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel your father. Reuben was the firstborn. Reuben was the oldest boy. He should have gotten the birthright. The Abrahamic birthright should have come straight down to Reuben now. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellency of power, but you're unstable as water. Thou shalt not excel, because you went up to your father's bed, and defilest thou it, and he went up on my couch. He went up and slept with one of his father's concubines. For doing that, he loses his birthright. Now, asking again, was it foreordained that he would lose his birthright? Sure, just as much as it was foreordained that Esau would lose the birthright. Did he nevertheless, of his own apparent free will, go up to his father's bed and sleep with the concubine and lose the birthright as a result? Yeah, absolutely. God is in control of this because it's going to go to Joseph. Don't forget that when these guys were all teenagers, Joseph had dreams that he would have the preeminence. So God told him early on, you'll be the one. Sure enough, in the course of time and the events of history, Reuben would do exactly what it took to lose the birthright. Verse 5. Simeon and Levi are brethren, born of the same mother. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. O my soul, come not thou into their secret, unto their assembly, mine honor. In other words, my honor would stay out of their assembly. Be not thou united, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they dig down a wall. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob, and I will scatter them in Israel. Okay, so the top three boys so far haven't exactly gotten a good report. Verse 8, suddenly he takes a dramatic left turn, and he says, Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be on the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp, or a young lion. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, and who shall raise him up, or rouse him up? The scepter, look at verse 10. What is a scepter?
Staff a king rules with.
Staff that a king rules with, exactly. So he says that scepter, that power to decide who lives and dies, that power to accept or not accept people, will never depart from Judah. It's going to be a descendant of Judah who will be the ultimate scepter bearer. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. In other words, the successive generations of children that grow up between his feet, from him will ultimately come the lawgiver. Now, was Moses a Judahite? No, he wasn't. Do you remember what he was?
Hebrew.
He was a Hebrew, but what tribe? You remember? This is important. He was a Levite. He was of the tribe of Levi. That's why the Levitical law, the book of Leviticus, all that stuff about Levi, he and his brother were both Levites. So where it says here that a lawgiver will not depart from Judah, it clearly wasn't talking about Moses, was it? There's some other superior lawgiver coming. And he then names who it's going to be. Nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. That word Shiloh is one of the most ancient words for a Messiah. The Shiloh, the leader. So look, he said, for the tribe of Judah, the scepter, which is the power, and the ability to give the laws will not depart until Shiloh comes. In other words, Shiloh will be the culmination of all that. And unto him, Shiloh, shall the gathering of the people be. That means the gathering of the tribes, the gathering of the Gentiles, the gathering of the world will be to Shiloh. So in other words, they already knew at the point of Israel handing out the blessings that the Messiah, the one who would serve to unite them, was coming through Judah. That's why it was very important that when Jesus was born, he was born into the tribe of Judah. What's he called in the book of Revelation? The Lion of the Tribe of Judah. So here it was saying, in Judah there was going to be a lion, a young lion who would become an old lion that no one could stir up or rouse because he would be so powerful. And Jesus is that Lion of the Tribe of Judah. So way back here, Israel was already predicting that Jesus was going to come, the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. Verse 11 says, binding his foal unto the vine, a foal is a small colt or an ass's colt, his ass's colt unto the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. Now, remember it says that when Jesus comes back in the book of Revelation, do you remember the description?
He comes on a horse.
He comes on a horse, and what's on his vesture and his garment? He's got blood on the vesture and on the garments. He comes back exactly as was described here. It says that he threshed out the threshing floor of God's wrath. So the description of Shiloh here was not only that he would have power and that he would give the law and that he would gather the people and that he would come back as the one who had his clothes washed in the garments of wine and the blood of grapes. Now, I've told you before that the way that they get the wine out of grapes is that they crush it. That word for crushing grapes, do you remember what the word is in the Greek? Thlipsis. Do you remember what the English word thlipsis is? Tribulation. That's exactly it. So all the way back here, the tribulation was predicted. That Christ would take the blood of the grapes through the thlipsis, through the crushing, through the tribulation. He bore our tribulation on the cross. And he's coming back with that vesture dipped in blood when he comes back to clean up the earth. He's coming back in judgment. Isn't that amazing? All that back here, Israel, just blessing his kids. And by the way, the one other thing I find interesting in verse 11 is that it says, binding his foal unto the vine and his ass's colt. Do you remember when Jesus was going to come into Jerusalem, the triumphal entry, a week before he was killed? Do you remember how he rode in? On an ass's colt, didn't he? And he said to his disciples, he said, go over to a certain place, there will be a certain man, and he will have a donkey and an ass's colt, same language, a baby donkey that's never been ridden on. You bring those to me, and I'm going to ride them in. Never been ridden in its whole life, which means it should have bucked and jerked and jumped. But when the master of the universe sat on it, it just said, fine, where do you want to go? Walked him into Jerusalem, and at his triumphal entry, they sang, Hosanna, Hosanna to the Son of David. They were crowning him king. You are the King of Israel. You're the one we've been waiting for. You are the Messiah. You are Shiloh to come. And they sang, you're our king. You're the one that we've been waiting for. That was the triumphal crowning entry of the King of Israel in fulfillment of this very verse right here, that he would come on an ass's colt. In the book of Psalms, it says that he would come meek and lowly and riding on an ass's colt. How did David know that? Well, he'd been reading back here. It's great stuff. So, his eyes are red with wine and his teeth are white with milk. Verse 13, he turns to Zebulun, his next son, and says, Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea. He shall be for a haven of ships, and his border shall be unto Zidon. Issachar is a strong ass couching down between two burdens. In other words, his whole life he'll be a burden bearer. He's going to have something on his back to have to carry his whole life. And he saw that rest was good and the land that it was pleasant, and he bowed his shoulder to bear the load, and he became a servant unto tribute. Dan shall judge his people. What's the word Dan mean, by the way?
Judge.
Judge, exactly. It says, Dan shall judge his people. Now, I'll tell you, too, that there are alternative explanations and alternative interpretations of that verse. Here he says, Dan shall judge his people. I have read interpretations of that verse that say it should be Dan is judged of the people. In the Hebrew, it can go either way. In the book of Revelation, when the 144,000 show up, do you remember which tribe is missing?
Dan.
Dan's not named in the 144,000. So it's interesting, if the interpretation here is that Dan will be judged of his people, then that would be that judgment. And in the end time, when the 144,000 are gathered. By the way, the tribe that first introduced idol worship into the northern tribes of Ephraim was Dan. Interesting, huh? Before that ever happened, he said, Dan shall be judged of his people. It's interesting. Dan shall be a serpent by the way and an adder in the path. That's bad news. If you're walking down a path and a serpent and an adder, a poisonous snake, jumps out and bites you in the heel. He said, that's what Dan's like. That bites the horse's heel so that the riders fall off backwards. Somebody look at Judges 18:30. Somebody go over there and look at that. Joshua judges Ruth. Judges 18:30. You got it?
Yeah.
Read it out loud.
There the Danites set up for themselves the idols, and Jonathan, son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests for the tribe of Dan until the time of captivity. it's spreading, of captivity of the land.
Okay, that's the verse right there that is the first time that you find when they went into the land during the time of Judges. It's the first time that you hear about somebody setting up idols. And who was it that did it?
Danites.
Dan. The Danites went and set up the idols and introduced idol worship into Israel. So now you see that he was, in fact, an adder and a snake. And, of course, the serpent is always a symbol of demonic things and devilish things. And he was the tool through which the devil introduced idol worship into Israel. And Israel likened that to just biting the horse's hoofs so that the horses would buck up and the people would fall down backwards. Verse 18. I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord. Gad, one of the sons, a troop shall overcome him, and he shall be overcome at the last. In other words, he's going to fall in war. Out of Asher his bread shall be fat, and he shall yield royal dainties. I'll be honest with you, I've read several different people try to interpret that verse. Nobody knows what that means. What we know for sure is whatever becomes of Asher, he's apparently going to live pretty well. And he's going to have royal dainties, which means things that were cooked for royalty. So apparently Asher's going to live pretty well. And he's going to have bread and fat. Out of Asher shall be bread and fat, and he shall yield royal dainties. Naphtali is a hind let loose. A hind is a deer. He's a hind let loose, and he giveth goodly words. In other words, he's going to run all over the place and apparently be pretty talkative. But Joseph, now he turns to Joseph, and the rest, all the way down to verse 28, is all about Joseph. When he turns to, like, Naphtali, turns to Gad, he says barely a sentence about him. The Shiloh is going to come through Judah. The scepter and lawgiving will never depart from Judah. But then to make sure that everybody understands where the birthright blessing is going, he turns to Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. He said he's going to be like a vineyard planted by a well, so that it just grows and grows and grows. The archers have sorely grieved him and shot at him and hated him. In other words, he's going to have a tough time. There's going to be a lot of war. He's going to be hated, but his bow abode in strength, so he's going to defeat his enemies. And the arm of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. That verse, by the way, that's why it's in parenthesis in some of your versions. He's saying that out of Israel, out of Jacob, is going to come the shepherd, not out of Joseph. We already know that he's going to come out of Judah. Look at verse 25. Even by God, the God of thy fathers, who shall help thee, and by the Almighty who shall bless thee with the blessings of heaven above, the blessings of the deep that lieth under, the blessing of the breasts and of the womb, the blessings of thy father have prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors unto the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him that was separate from his brethren. So where did the birthright promise go? Went to Joseph, didn't it? So for the first time now, with Abraham, there was the promise that he would have the land and that he would subdue his enemies and that he would have his enemies' gates. But the big promise to Abraham was that through him, all nations would be blessed. And that total package of blessing was passed down from generation to generation to generation till it got to these 12 boys. And for the first time, you see those two halves of that blessing, of that promise, of the Abrahamic covenant, split to two different boys. And you see the promise of Shiloh, through whom all the nations will be blessed, given to Judah. But you see the birthright promise of the land and defeating his enemies, having the gates of his enemies and being blessed and being of God and being God's people, that all went over here to Joseph. And before it went to Joseph, who did it go to? Ephraim. The two boys came in and he said the blessing's going to go to Ephraim. So Joseph's portion goes to Ephraim. I'm going to show you that in just a second too. Now he closes up with Benjamin. Benjamin's the youngest. Benjamin shall raven as a wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is that their fathers spake unto them, and he blessed them everyone according to the blessings that he blessed them. Take a look at 1 Chronicles 5. 1. Everybody go there. I want you to see this.
Jim.
Yes.
You know that the curses and the blessings here?
Mm-hmm.
It's, if you could find the 10 Truk tribes nowadays, they would be living their curse? Or
yes, I think so. Yeah. And I think someday when we get to heaven and we get to overlook the great panorama of time, that God will show us that that's exactly how he controlled human history, that they lived out these curses and blessings. And I'll ask you a question then, Bruce. Did, in fact, Shiloh come through Judah?
Right. Yes.
Sure, Messiah came through Judah, didn't he? So there you have the first evidence of an absolutely concise physical fulfillment of one of these promises. So then can't you believe in an absolutely concise physical fulfillment of the others? Sure. 1 Chronicles 5. We're just going to...
13 kids,
I'm sorry? Yeah, that's a little bit of the confusion there, is that there were 12 tribes, 12 boys, but there were two sons of Joseph, which would have made 13, because Joseph's lot went to Ephraim and Manasseh, his two sons. But then God took away the land lot from Levi and put Levi into work in the temple and made them the priests. So there were, in fact, 12 land divisions of 12 tribes. Levi was scattered among all the tribes, always serving as God's priests among his brethren.
So the two, Joseph, they actually,
right,
isn't actually a tribe.
Right, there is no tribe of Joseph.
Right,
Dan is a tribe.
Right.
When you read the 12 tribes of Israel from that point forward, you see a tribe of Ephraim and a tribe of Manasseh, and you don't ever see a tribe of Joseph. Despite what the Jehovah Witnesses may say when they show up at your door. In fact, I'll tell you how the tribes divided up in just a second. We'll get to that. But first I want to show you that I'm not creating some kind of anti-biblical theology when I say that the Abrahamic covenant was divided up among two different tribes. Because this is something that a lot of people don't get. A lot of people don't see that at the point of blessing, when Israel handed out the specific blessings to his 12 sons, that he divided up the Abrahamic covenant between two of the tribes. That Shiloh, that Messiah, that Jesus, the lawgiver, who would be the ruler, who would have the scepter, would definitely come through Judah. But the rest of the Abrahamic covenant would continue to go through Ephraim. The birthright would go to Ephraim. And just so you know that I didn't just make that up, 1 Chronicles says, 1 Chronicles 5, verse 1, "Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but for as much as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel. And the genealogy is not to be reckoned then after the birthright. For Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler. But the birthright was Joseph's." Did you get that? Clearly then here, the chronicler keeping track of Israel's history points out that the birthright went to Joseph's sons. But the genealogy through which the Messiah would come would flow through Judah. So that's why when you open the New Testament and you open the book of Matthew, what's the first thing you read?
Genealogy.
The genealogy. He starts with the genealogy. It was very, very important to be able to prove that the Messiah would find his roots through David back to Judah. That was very, very important. So that's why as soon as you start the New Testament, the first thing you read is the genealogy that proves that. So the book of Chronicles says the genealogy to the Messiah would go through Judah, but the birthright went to Joseph's sons. Yeah?
What will encompass the birthright? What will Ephraim get?
The land promise, Canaan, being regathered into Canaan, possessing the gates of his enemies, which is why he said that Joseph would be, even though he would be at war, his bow would prevail. Blessing and cursing, those who God blesses will be blessed. The same thing he said to Abraham, everything except the promise of Messiah, that through you would all the nations of the earth be blessed.
It'll be all material.
All the material, physical promises. Yep.
Did the amillennials sometimes think it's fulfilled because it came to Judah? They're looking at nothing.
Yes. Ta-da! Very good. Yes. And that's the point that I can't seem to get across to people as if they would pay attention to the details of the Old Testament, because they won't do the work that it takes to read the Old Testament and figure out how all this stuff fits. They've come to the conclusion that because Israel is established over there with the Jews, that that is the fulfillment of all this, and it's all done.
Two opposite things.
It's two opposite things.
But
that's right.
Let me ask one other question.
Sure.
And I don't mean to question what you're saying.
Please question what I'm saying.
Understand.
Yes.
How do you know that the people that are being gathered over there now are Jews?
Good question. It's the next place to go. Right.
Naphtali.
they're Naphtali. Who knew? Yeah, exactly. They're Zebulun. Here they come. No. Okay, now we got to do a little bit of history of what.
I don't mean to take you far away now.
No, that's okay. That's the next place we have to go. So that's fine. That's fine. Those 12 boys, with their curses and blessings on them, all have families and they all grow. They grow in Egypt because Joseph is the ruler of Egypt, and he sets them up as princes over different areas, different lands, the Hyksos, the shepherd rulers of Egypt, okay? The book of Exodus begins by saying, there rose up a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. So enough time had passed that Joseph and his brothers had all passed away. Those 12 tribes then became the nation of Israel growing inside of Egypt. So a Pharaoh grew up who didn't know Joseph, never knew what Joseph did for Egypt, didn't know, didn't care about the drought, didn't care that all the power that had been amassed to the Pharaohs had been amassed through Joseph. He didn't figure he owed these Israelites anything, but what he knew for sure is they weren't Egyptians. And his fear was that if one of the enemies of Egypt came to war, that they might very well turn with the enemy against Egypt. So the Pharaoh decreed that all of the Israelites living in Egypt would become slaves. And they took their land and their property and their wealth and their cattle and their everything else, and they enslaved them. Now that was perfectly in keeping with the Abrahamic promise. Abraham said to God, how do I know I'll inherit this land? And the promise was, your children, your offspring, are going to go into a land where they're not known, and there they will serve them for 400 years. So first he had to get them there, which he did through Joseph. Then he had to multiply them, which he did. Then he had to put them into servitude, which he did. They were servants in Egypt for 430 years. In the midst of all that servitude, there was also the belief, because they had it here, 400 years, they knew when the 400 years was coming up, the Israelites knew full well that there was going to be a deliverer coming. We're supposed to be here for 400 years, and gee, it's 398 now. There must be someone on the way. Well, that got noised around, and Pharaoh heard about it. Pharaoh heard there was a deliverer that was supposed to come in that generation, and so he said, well, I'll solve that. Let's just kill all the kids. Every male child born to the Israelites, we'll just drown them in the river. Just drown them. Get rid of them. Kill them all. Then he brought in all of the midwives who delivered the babies in Israel and said to them, if you help birth a male child, it is your responsibility to drown that child or I'll kill you. So there was one woman who happened to be a Levite, who happened to have a husband who was a Levite, who happened to have a kid, and he was a beautiful kid, it said, and that he was just a goodly child, and they just couldn't bring themselves to kill it, and they swore the midwife to secrecy. And they took the kid and they put him in what was called an ark, just something that would float. They covered it with pitch, that same word, atonement. They covered it with kafar, the covering, the atonement, and they put the baby in it. And they drifted him off down the very same river they were supposed to drown him in. And you know the story. That same river that was supposed to drown that child drifted him right into Pharaoh's court. Pharaoh's out to kill that one baby. He's killing every baby he can get his hands on to kill that one kid. So God drifted that kid right into his house.
And they raised him.
And raised him. Yeah. Not only are you not going to kill him, you're going to feed him and raise him. It's great. It's God working. So Pharaoh's daughter just happens to be out bathing in the river. La-di-da-da. Hey, what's this? It's a baby. And of course, like I said, a goodly, beautiful baby. And she knows the rules, and she knows all that, but she says, I can't kill this kid. This kid's great. I'll raise him like one of mine. I'm going to raise me up a kid. And then says, wait a minute, I haven't been pregnant. I can't feed this child. And says to her servant, go find me one of the nursing women, because there were nursing women all over the place who had given birth and then their children were killed. So there were all these women, Israelitish women, ready to nurse. She said, go find me a nursing mother to come feed this baby. And so meanwhile, Moses' older sister had been in the reeds and the rushes of the water watching the ark with the baby in it float so that she could go back and tell her mom whatever happened to the kid. And she sees the servant take off and goes and interrupts the servant and says, hey, where you headed? She's looking for a nursing mother of Israel. And she says, I just happen to know one. So Moses' own mother, under the watchful eye of Pharaoh, nursed her own child and raised him up. The one kid he was trying to kill. There's providence. So anyway, nursing mom, Moses' mom, gets to watch her child grow up to be Pharaoh's own kid. Second only to Ramses, his half-brother. Well, one day mom decides to tell Moses his real heritage and explains to him how he got here and who he is and what's up with all this. And he starts to feel a kinship for his Israelitish brethren who are under a horrible slavery. Moses rises up and says, you know, we need to revolt. We need to rise up. This is the time. God's going to deliver us. This is the time. Moses is going to work it out in his own flesh. You know, Moses is going to do it under his own power. I'm the one. Here we go. Pharaoh's guards come out and say, oh, you don't like the work you have to do? How about if we double your brick production? How about if we make it twice as hard and give you half as much straw and water to do it with? And if production falls, we'll torture you and beat you and kill you for it. So his brethren all come to him and go, oh, thanks, Moses. Nice work. It's worse now than it ever was. So he hides. Well, while he's hiding, he sees one of his brethren, one of the Israelites, being beaten by one of the Egyptian taskmasters. And he gets so mad, he runs out and hits the guy with a stone, and it kills him. So he buries the body in the sand, packs up everything he owns, and he ditches for the desert. Now, he's got in his head that he's the deliverer. He knows the prophecy that the Israelites have got to be delivered. He tried to deliver them under his own power, and all he did was make it much worse for them. And he went out to the backside of the desert, it says, which is like just past nowhere, on the backside of the desert. And you know how long he was out there? 40 years. 40 years. You know how long he was in Egypt? 40 years. Any of this sounding familiar? You know how long he marched in the wilderness with these roughneck people? 40 years. What's the number of 40 in the Bible?
Judgment.
Judgment, trial, sure. So 40 years in the desert on the backside of nowhere. He bumps into some traveling nomads, starts living with them. This guy named Jethro. Jethro happens to have himself a daughter named Zipporah. He marries Zipporah. They knock out a couple kids. He's living in the middle of nowhere. He figures, well, you know, I was deluded. I can see him trying to tell the story. Hey, you know, I used to be Pharaoh's kid. Yeah, right. Just get the sheep, okay?
Too much sun
out here in the desert. Well, so he's just out one day with the sheep and the cattle when he sees a bush burning that isn't burning up. There's just a burning bush that doesn't seem to be consumed by the flames, and it says that he actually turned to go look at it, because that caught his attention. So he goes over to the burning bush, and the bush, out of the bush comes a voice that speaks to him and says, take off your sandals, you're standing on holy ground. The voice calls him by name, Moses. Moses knew exactly who he was, knew where he was, knew what he'd been up to, and knew where he'd been for 40 years. Isn't that amazing? God knew right where Moses was, right where he'd stuck him. The same God that protected him and had his own mother raise him under Pharaoh's nose. That very same God stuck him out there for 40 years in the middle of nowhere in the desert and said, now, you humble enough yet? Can we talk? You ready to stop pretending you're the deliverer? Let's remember, I'm God, I'm the deliverer. I'm God, you're not. Notice the burning bush. Now he said, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go back to Egypt. And you're going to go to Pharaoh, and you're going to say, let my people go. I, God, want my people to come out here so that they can worship me. I want to be worshiped by my people, and I want to bring them out of Israel, and I want them to come out so that they can worship freely in front of me. You go tell Pharaoh to let them go. And he says, who should I say sent me? He's going to say, what's the name of your God? Because don't forget, the Egyptians had a pantheon of gods, and they all had names for their gods. And he said, who should I say is the God that said this? Because I'm going to say, God says, let my people go. And they're going to go, which God is that? So what do I tell them? Which God? And God said, you tell them the God that says, I am because I am, said, let my people go. Good name. I am that I am. That's all you need to know. In other words, all those gods of Egypt aren't. I am. You go tell them the God that says, I am, said, let my people go. And God points out, oh yeah, he's not going to listen to you. He's not going to let him go. But I'm going to kill his firstborn son. It's amazing. God predicted it early on. He said, you know what? He took my firstborn, Israel. Israel is my firstborn, says God to Moses. Israel is my firstborn, and he took my firstborn, so I'm going to take his firstborn. Remember that night when the death angel came through the camp and killed all the firstborn and killed Pharaoh's firstborn? You know what that was? That was revenge for taking Israel, God's firstborn. Exodus 4:22. Actually, 4:21. This is another little concept that's firmly ensconced in the Old Testament that people miss. The things God did, he didn't do randomly. The Lord said unto Moses, starting at verse 21, Exodus 4:21, the Lord said unto Moses, when you go, return unto Egypt, or into Egypt, see that thou do all those wonders before Pharaoh. Moses has been arguing with God about this. And he said, how am I going to prove that God really sent me? And he said, you see that walking stick in your hand? And he says, yeah. He says, throw it down. So he throws it down and it becomes a snake. And then he reaches down and picks it up and becomes a stick again. And he says, do that in front of Pharaoh. And then he argues and says, well, I'm slow, I'm cleft of tongue, I don't speak very well. And he says, I'm going to give you your brother. So, when you go and return into Egypt, see that you do those wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in thine hand. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that he shall not let the people go. Do you see God's absolute sovereign control in this? He says, you go say, let my people go. And God has already promised to Abraham that after 400 years, those people would go. But God is also going to punish the people who held him, which he told Abraham. He said, that nation whom they serve, I will punish. He told Abraham that back when he gave him the promises. That's a sovereign God who gets to say, I will judge you if you don't respond to me, and then harden your heart so you won't respond to him. But I will harden his heart that he will not let my people go. Verse 22 says, and thou shalt say unto Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. And I say unto thee, let my son go, that he may serve me. And if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn.
That's an ultimatum.
It's not really an ultimatum, because he said, if you don't let them go, I'll slay your firstborn. And then he said, but believe me, I'm going to harden his heart. He's not going to let him go, and I am going to slay his firstborn. Isn't that something? People ask all the time when we talk about election. Pardon me?
It's not fair.
It's not fair. Absolutely. People all the time talk about election, have difficulty with election, and they want to say, well, if what you're saying is true, then you're saying that it's up to God who goes to heaven and who goes to hell. And I say, yeah. And they go, well, that's not fair, because those people who go to hell didn't have a chance. But you know what? This very same story we just read, Paul is going to pick up in the book of Romans. And in his argument on election, he's going to say that God hardened Pharaoh's heart and raised Pharaoh up and made him Pharaoh for the very purpose of judging him.
Yeah, God
is
fair. Yeah. Everybody should go to hell.
That's exactly right. God has the absolute right to save, to judge. Absolute right. And he has the absolute right to judge absolutely everybody, because absolutely everybody are sinners in God's sight. That's where grace comes in. That's why I keep pounding grace and the theology of grace here. God was under no obligation to do anything whatsoever for Christy. Christy was absolutely condemned and deserved to go to hell forever. Do you believe that, Christy? Do you know that's true? Do you know enough about yourself to know that you really, if God judged you and put you in hell, that he'd be within his rights? Isn't that amazing then that he didn't do it? Isn't that astounding? That not only did he decide not to put Christy in hell, but then introduced himself to her, drew Christy to himself, and then began conforming Christy into the image of his son, and then will take Christy to heaven and give her a share in the rewards that Christ only deserves. That's grace. Well, way back here, he said to Moses, guess what, Moses? My firstborn, I'm bringing them out. But the very same people who held them in servitude, which thing I predicted they would do and drove in human history to make them do, I'm going to judge them for doing it. And harden Pharaoh's heart so that I can say, you kept my firstborn Israel, and I'm going to take your firstborn in response. Moses is going to take these people out. The burning bush has said, go tell them. He does, in fact, go tell them. As Bruce just pointed out, there were seven plagues, terrible plagues. It's a plague of frogs. Think about it. That's the one that creeps me out the most. It says that whenever they would take out their kneading dough or the pans to cook their bread in, that they were full of frogs. Frogs in their clothes. The frogs covered the ground. You couldn't walk without stepping on frogs. There were frogs everywhere coming up out of the Nile River. Frogs. That's the one that creeps me out. But the lice, okay, there were thick lice everywhere. Okay, everybody had to, okay, lice, I get it, but frogs, I don't know, just too many problems for me. There were locusts that came and ate all of the fields. There were sicknesses of boils and stuff that came up on the people, and big boils that came up on their skin that killed all their cattle and their sheep. Moses went over with his staff and dipped it in the Nile River, and the river became blood. And it says that after a couple days, all of Egypt stunk. Because, you know, blood starts to stink real fast. They'd go to their fountains, they'd go to their wells, they'd go anywhere. Blood came out. And then, of course, hail that turned into fire. You don't see that every day. So it was damaging hail coming down, men running, trying to cover it, getting in the caves, trying to get away from the hail. But then if it wasn't enough that you got pelted with the hail would burst into flames, which burned up all their property and fields and everything else. That's a bad plague. Then there was 3 days of darkness, where it says, the description of the book of Exodus was, it was so dark, such an oppressive darkness, that if you lit a flame, if you went and got a torch to find your way, the darkness engulfed the light. So when you lit a flame, it got darker. For 3 days, men didn't even get up out of their beds, wouldn't move, wouldn't go anywhere for three straight days because you couldn't see thing one. The entire nation was in darkness. But over in Goshen, where the Israelites were, lit up bright. Isn't that amazing? You know that when the lice came, the lice ran through Egypt. Over here in Goshen, where the Israelites were, no lice. That means that God is sovereign over lice. Sovereign over swarms of locusts. God is sovereign over light. Talk about absolute sovereignty. Yes.
Isn't it for 3 days or was it 3 hours?
When Christ was hanging on the cross? And when Christ was hanging on the cross, it says there was 3 hours of darkness. Yep. The sun was darkened and for 3 hours, nobody could. Now, Isaiah says God was pouring out his wrath on his son. And it says that his visage, which is his physical body, was so tormented and racked with pain. Marred is the word in the Old Testament, which means he was physically so reshaped, his face and his body was so destroyed as God poured out his wrath for 3 hours, that God, rather than let anybody look on his damaged son for 3 hours, put darkness on while he poured out his wrath on his son so that nobody could look on this shameful sight of the Son of God being physically beaten to death. He forecasts that back here, 3 days of darkness. Then finally, he says to Moses, okay, here's the deal. Everybody get a lamb. Everybody take your lamb. I've taught on this extensively when we've taken communion together. Everybody get a lamb. Bring it up in your house for 3 days so that you learn to love the lamb. It's got to be an innocent lamb. It has to be a baby lamb. It has to be a lamb that everybody falls in love with. And then on the third day, get your kids, get the old people, get everybody in a room. And right there in front of everybody, you grab that lamb by the back of the head and you lift him up and you slice his neck open. And the blood flows. And that's hard on the kids. And you got to tell them, this is what sin requires. Blood. Here it comes. Here comes the blood. Then he says, you take that baby lamb and you cook him. And you cook that baby lamb, make sure there's no water, no blood left in that baby lamb, and he has to be completely seized, cooked all the way through. Meanwhile, you sit down at your tables with your sandals on, with your walking staff in your hand, fully robed, ready to go. And you sit and eat this meal. You eat that Passover lamb, you eat the bitter herbs that remind you of the bitterness of your captivity. You drink the wine that became the cup that Jesus picked up and said, this cup is now the cup of the New Testament in my blood. He said, and you eat these things ready to go. Unleavened bread, that was the other thing. Have the unleavened bread there. The bread that was the body that had no sin in it. The type of the Christ that was to come. You sit here and eat this with your staff in hand ready to go. And oh yeah, one more thing. When you kill that baby lamb, the price of sin, make sure that you take a hyssop, which was like a paintbrush. It was a hyssop was a branch that had a lot of little branches on it. And he said, you take the hyssop branch and you dip it in the blood and you put it on the doorpost and on the lintel of your door across the top and the sides. You make sure there's blood on your doorstep. And you shut the door and you go inside and you eat. And no matter what you hear and no matter what's going on outside, you stay inside covered by that blood because the death angel's coming. And when the death angel comes, if it sees the blood of the sacrificial lamb on the door of your house, it will pass over you. That's where the Passover comes from. When I see the blood, I'll pass over you. Which, by the way, is, of course, the type of Christ. When the death angel comes looking for you, he's looking for one thing. He's looking for that blood. If the death angel comes looking for you and you've got the blood, passes over you. God will let you go. You belong to God. He can go kill all the children of Egypt he wants, but he can't get to you. So, sure enough, through that night, it says there was screaming and wailing through all of Egypt through the night. They're sitting there, staff in hand, ready to go, eating the Passover lamb, waiting on the blood, and the death angel comes and kills every firstborn cattle, every firstborn sheep, every firstborn, all the way to Pharaoh's house and kills Pharaoh's firstborn son, exactly like God said he was going to do. Pharaoh says, get Moses, get him now. Go get Moses. It's the middle of the night. Get Moses! Calls Moses in and says, all right, you can go. That's enough. Moses, meanwhile, had told all the Egyptians, or all the Israelites, at the word of God, go to all your Egyptian neighbors and borrow everything you can borrow. Get their earrings, get their rings, get their gold bracelets, get their clothes, get their shoes, get everything you can get from your neighbors. And believe me, they'll give it to you. They've been through seven plagues. They're going to give you anything you want. So they suddenly are rich. When they walk out of there, they're wearing all the great Egyptian clothes, and they got the jewelry, and they got the earrings. They don't look like slaves when they go marching out. They look like a wealthy nation marching out of there because God said to Abraham they would serve them for 400 years and come out richer than when they went in. And he did it. It's amazing. Controlled human history for another 400 years to make it come out exactly the way he said it would happen. So they come out richer than when they went in, and do you know that the Bible says that for the next 40 years while they walked in the desert that the leather of their shoes never wore out? The clothes they wore never wore out. They had that great shoe leather that never wore out. Wore it for 40 years, wandering in the wilderness. So it also says that when they went out, there wasn't a halt, a lame, or a blind person among them. Now, I got to figure that if you're slaves for 400 years in Egypt, the chances that there's somebody in your group that's lame is pretty high, right? Somebody that halts, can't walk very good, that's got to be in there. But God, before he started them walking, made sure they could all see and they could all walk. Why? Because he was going to lead them. They had to be able to see him and they had to be able to walk. So, off they go marching. It's the middle of the night. Great clamor. Off they go. They get as far as the Red Sea. No sooner have they gone than Pharaoh says, you know, I've changed my mind. Let's go get him. What was that? That was God hardening his heart. Get him out and then change his mind again. He says, let's go get him. Let's go kill him. Let's go catch him. They're caught between the Red Sea and Pharaoh's army. And down come the two elements of God that walked through the broken animals that promised Abraham that all this would happen. And those same two elements, the cloud of smoke and the pillar of fire, that walked through the broken animals and said to Abraham, I'm going to control human history to bring your descendants back to this very land that I promised you. Those two elements come down from heaven and get between the Israelites and the Egyptians and become light in the night for the Israelites and become a cloud of darkness to the Egyptians, and the whole Egyptian army grinds to a halt because it's too dark for him to go anywhere. Meanwhile, over on the bright side, Moses raises up that staff again over the Red Sea, and the Red Sea opens up. And Moses said, stand still to these people who are going, why'd you bring us out here to die? Here comes the army. We're going to all die. We're going to, never happy. Just like us. My hamburger's not cooked. Never happy. Complaining about everything. I know you're in control, God, but this hurts. Never happy. Moses turns around and gives them the advice that we all need. He turns and says, stand still. And they all stand still for a minute, and he says, now behold the deliverance of God. Turns around, raises up his rod, and the Red Sea opens. He says, all right, let's go. Everybody through. As the last Israelite is passing through the water, the cloud lifts. Just enough for the Egyptians to be able to say, look! Look what they're doing! Go get them! The last Israelite makes his way to dry land on the other side when the whole army goes, let's go get them. Down into the water they go. Hey, if they can do it, we can do it. Another big falsehood in life. If you can do it, I can do it. No, I'm doing it by the power of God. You can't do it. They all tumble down into the ocean and God closes up the ocean. And there's Pharaoh's army done away with. Pharaoh, all his army, gone. So God says, here's the deal. First you get all their riches. Then I'll drown your debtors. And then I'll take you off into the wilderness with all this stuff. So, leaping forward, I'm going to take some 70-league leaps here. They make their way back to Canaan after 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. But, go to the book of Joshua. Joshua 5. I'm sitting here yakking. I'm getting there. Okay, I really thought that I would get through all this today, and I'm not going to, but that's life. You know what? I'll tell you what. You know what? Let's just sit there for a second, because... I mean, hold the Joshua thing for a second, Joshua 5. Just hold on to that for a second. We'll get back to it. Let me make sure that I do at least answer that question today. I'm going to answer Bruce's question, then we're going to go on. I have to leap forward in our history lesson here to get to the answer to your question, but it's a good question. It needs an answer. When the 12 tribes finally make it into Canaan after 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, after they've been to Sinai and they've gotten the law, one of the things I wanted to establish for you today, and if we don't get it today, I'm going to show it to you tomorrow. Did you know that circumcision, which is really what the big subject is here, do you know that circumcision is not taught in the Sinai law? Comes a big shock, don't it? Theologians go, huh! Circumcision is a token of the Abrahamic covenant, and circumcision is assumed in the Sinai law. It's mentioned a couple of times. In fact, there are two actual references to circumcision in the whole Sinaitic law.
Well, they're right about the circumcision. They were going back, referring it to when it was a...
referring it back to Abraham.
Right.
It's a token of the Abrahamic covenant. But the confusion in the New Testament, and this is why it's so important to get your theology straight, is that the confusion in the New Testament is that when people read the word circumcision, they think Mosaic law. Circumcision is not a type or a symbol or a shadow or a token of the Mosaic law. It's of the Abrahamic covenant. He didn't have to, in the law, say circumcise your kids. You know why? They were already doing it in response to the Abrahamic covenant. And he never includes it in the law as something for them to do in the law. Why is that important? Because when the law went away, circumcision for Jews did not go away because it was not part of the Mosaic law. Yes, the Mosaic law went away in the New Testament. But you know what? Circumcision, the token of the Abrahamic covenant, didn't go away. You know why? Because the Abrahamic covenant didn't go away.
Still exists.
Still exists. That's right. And that's why Jews to this day are still circumcising their kids as they ought to. Because they're the descendants of Abraham physically.
What was the
Get that?
Covenant again?
the promise to Abraham that they would come back to that land,
right,
that they would gather in Canaan, that they would get that physical place to live, possess the gates of their enemies, through them all the nations of the earth would be blessed, that God would be their God and he would be their people.
Where did the circumcision come in?
As a token of the Abrahamic covenant, God added circumcision and told Abraham, as a token of the people who are under this covenant, you will circumcise your children through all your generations.
Christ only fulfilled part of the Abrahamic covenant.
Absolutely. Yeah. Christ fulfilled a part of the Abrahamic covenant. Which part? The part that went to Judah. Right? He fulfilled the Judah part of the Abrahamic covenant. But did he fulfill the Ephraim part? No. Will he? Yeah.
Yeah, Judah came Christ. And then
through Judah came Christ, yes.
And then Ephraim came the land and all the good stuff, right? No.
Ta-da. Okay. That's exactly right. You get it. Right. You get it. That's a very big theological construct that people don't get. Now, when the 12 tribes went into Israel, this is answering Bruce's question. If we get this done, we'll have had a good day. This is Old Testament Theology 101. If you don't know your Old Testament theology, you can't possibly understand New Testament theology, which is why I go crazy about New Testament churches, because they're creating their theology from the New Testament and ignoring all the Old Testament theology. Okay, now, the 12 tribes make their way to Canaan. There's actually 13 of them. God divides up the land. He specifically says, which tribe will get what piece of land? The Levites don't get a piece of land. They're scattered among all of the tribes, and they become the priests that serve in the temples and in the tabernacles and serve their brethren as the priests of God. Got that picture? Okay, now they were united as 12 tribes, as one nation, the whole time that they were under the judges. They wanted a king. God gave them King Saul, even though they were warned that he was going to be a bad king for them. But they said, we just want a king. We want to be like everybody else. God says, oh, it's not good enough that you have God for your king? All right, fine, fine, fine. Just like us. Not happy. I don't want to just have God. I want to be like everybody else. Anyways, he says, I have chosen you a king who will be a king after my own heart. You remember who that king was?
David.
Saul was the bad king. He was replaced by David, the shepherd king, who was, when he was anointed, was out watching his father's flocks. Oh, gee, there's a type. He's anointed to be the king of Israel. He eventually becomes the king, and only under David, when David moves his capital, his throne, he moves it from Hebron to Jerusalem. It's at Jerusalem that David is king and has his throne. It's where he rules from for the majority of his kingdom. That's where the temple is built and where God says he chose to place his name. That's why Jerusalem to this day is the only city on planet Earth where God ever said, I will put my name on this place, Jerusalem. Which, by the way, you remember what Jerusalem means? Shalom, city of peace. Right.
City of peace?
Yeah. Today? Jeru-Shalom.
That's what I call it. Yep. Peace, but there's no peace.
Exactly right. But it will be the city of peace. You know when it'll be the city of peace? When the Prince of Peace sits in his temple in Jerusalem. And it will finally become what its name has predicted all these years. Now, under David, all 12 tribes are united. He has a son named Solomon. Solomon comes through Bathsheba. The first son through Bathsheba, by the way, who should have gotten the birthright. You remember what happened to him?
Got killed.
Got killed. Died as a baby. As punishment for killing Bathsheba's husband. Now, the 12 tribes united under David, Solomon is the heir apparent. Solomon is the wisest king that ever lived because God came to him one day and said, what do you want? For your father David's sake, because I loved your dad, a man after my own heart, what do you want? And he said, I just want the wisdom to rule your people well. God liked that. God said, good request. Since you didn't ask for something that you would just waste on yourself, I'm going to give you all the stuff to waste on yourself. Because you asked for wisdom. I'm going to give you wisdom, but I'm also going to make you the wealthiest, most powerful king the earth has ever seen. And then God punished him by giving him 2,000 wives and 3,000 concubines. And anyway, well, in the middle of all that, Solomon loved many strange women. What that meant was foreign women, women who were not Israelitish women, and they turned his heart toward foreign gods. And got him to go along with worshiping their gods because he liked the women too much and wouldn't stand up to the women and say, no, that's not the way this is going to work. And so in order to keep them happy, he starts worshiping foreign gods. God says, you know what? I'm taking the kingdom from you. Here's the way it's going to work.
Isn't that a form of hardening your heart, though, doing all that?
God knew what he was doing.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah. I'm saying that form
and chest.
Sure. Let me tell you something. Back in Ezekiel, the book of Isaiah, and in the book of Hosea, God refers to Israel while they're in Egypt as two sisters. So God always saw them as two separate kingdoms. Once he divided the birthright, from that point forward, he always saw them as two different things. There was Ephraim and there was Judah. And he calls them Ahola and Aholibah, the two names of the two women who went whoring down in Egypt. So he saw them as two women, two sisters, back in Egypt before they ever even got into their land. So God has always assumed that they were going to become two different kingdoms. Okay, now, one day Solomon's servant is walking down the road minding his own business, la-di-da-di-da, when up comes the prophet who grabs him, tears his cloak, and divides it into 12 pieces and gives him back 10 of those pieces of his coat that he ripped up. And he says, God has spoken to me and said, the kingdom of Solomon is going to be divided up and 10 of the nations of that kingdom are going to go to you. And he's just a servant. Solomon doesn't have an heir, a son. He says, you're going to get the 10 tribes that are going to be your kingdom. And then he says, two of them, though, for David's sake, are going to stay with Solomon. So then he goes and tells Solomon and says, you're going to get two of the original 12 tribes for your kingdom for David's sake. Because God had told David that the kingdom would always be David's kingdom, but he's narrowed down the kingdom. And guess which two tribes he got?
Benjamin and Judah.
Why Judah? Because through Judah, through David, the Messiah has to come. So he can't bust that up. And Benjamin, the youngest, because the area of the temple and the area of Jerusalem lays in the area of Benjamin, it was kind of hard for Benjamin to go to the northern kingdom. So Benjamin and Judah become known from that point forward as the southern kingdom called Judah. Okay? The northern tribes become the tribes of Jeroboam. Jeroboam is the king who was the servant of Solomon who gets the 10 northern tribes. No sooner does Jeroboam become king of the northern tribes than he becomes afraid that if the northern tribes and the southern tribes ever get together and realize that really they don't have that much against each other, they'll unite as one kingdom again and he won't be king anymore. So it says that right away he introduces forms of idol worship and separates them immediately from the southern kingdom by their worship of God. The Judahites, Judah and Benjamin, continue the Jewish form of worship. The northern tribes right away apostatize into various forms of idol worship designed by Jeroboam to keep the two kingdoms from ever becoming one again. Then you read 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, and you can read about the various kings that either were kings of Israel or kings of Judah. Kings of Israel or kings of Judah. 1 and 2 Kings are the chronicles of the kings from the northern tribes' view. 1 and 2 Chronicles are about the views of the kings from the southern tribes' view. And you can read about the litany of evil kings that the northern tribes had. Well, God, in order to punish the northern tribes for their idol worship. By the way, the northern tribes become known by their dominant tribe, and the name that they take on is the name of their dominant tribe. Just like the southern kingdom, the dominant tribe was Judah. Remember who the dominant tribe of the northerns were? Ephraim, the very ones who have the birthright. So the northern tribes start becoming called Ephraim, and the place where Ephraim meets is called Mount Ephraim. And so you see the northern area, Samaria, which is where we're going to get the Samaritans in Jesus' day. Samaria is the area where the northern tribes, the 10 tribes are gathered, known as Ephraim or Mount Ephraim. Get all this so far? Well, when the Syrians come into power and come to take Israel into captivity, they come take the northern tribes. But the southern tribes, Judah, remain intact. Why? Because through them, Shiloh's coming. God's got to keep them intact. But the northern tribes go into Syrian captivity.
Seems like they're getting punished all the time.
Sure they are, all the time. Well, you read the story. You read the curses. You read the kind of people they were. This is them. This is Dan. This is Zebulun. This is Reuben. This is those people. But in amongst them is that seed, Ephraim, in there amongst them. Well, when Babylon comes and finally defeats, or at least makes inroads into Syria, the Israelites are allowed to go back to their homeland. But when they come back to their homeland in the area of Samaria, what they find is that the Syrians had transplanted Syrian families that are now living in Samaria. So they come back to their homeland and there's people living there. So the vast majority of the northern kingdom don't come back and retake their land. And they all but disappear into history as they go off into the European middle areas and become marauding tribes. They're known by different names. Archaeology has found different names for them. At one point, they're called the Sakasuni, the sons of Isaac. Now, the important part is all the time that those northern tribes are getting scattered. Now, some of them, by the way, do end up taking up residence in Samaria, and they cross-marry with the Syrians that were living there, and they become the half-breeds, the dogs, called the Samaritans. Which is why, during the time of Jesus, they would talk about the Samaritans, that he must go through Samaria. And while he was there, there was a Samaritan woman, and his disciples come and say, "Why do you talk to her? She's a dog." These cross-breeds, these half-breeds, they're the descendants of the northern tribes that intermarried with the Assyrians. Get it now? So when he talks about the Good Samaritan, the story of the Good Samaritan, that was a great story because when he mentioned the Good Samaritan to the people who were listening, they went, "Samaritans aren't good. Samaritans are half-breed dogs. We don't like Samaritans." And Jesus said, "Yeah, but that's your brother. That's your neighbor." By the way, he treated the man who was fallen. So Samaritans play a big part of the New Testament. Babylon comes in and takes what's left of the northern tribes captive, and for the first time comes in and takes Judah, the southern tribes, captive as well. It's the first time Jerusalem fell to a foreign power when Babylon came in. And as we did the Revelation series, you saw Babylon and its influence. The southern tribes are returned to Judah, and they rebuild the temple, and they rebuild that under Nehemiah after the Babylonian Empire. Do you remember what the next empire to come in was? Medo-Persians, exactly. When the Medo-Persians come in, it's the Persian king, Cyrus, name by name, who comes and lets them come back, rebuild the temple, rebuild the city, and they rediscover the law, and they rediscover Judaism, and Judaism again is established in Jerusalem. Had to happen because true Jewish religion had to be happening in Jerusalem when Jesus walked in. Now, here's the important part to answer your question. All of that was background to answer your question. It's a real simple answer. Was the northern kingdom ever called Judah?
No.
No. The southern kingdom called Judah, the nickname of the Judahites was Jews. You can see where that word comes from now. Jew is a shortened version of Judah, Judahite. All the descendants of Abraham are Hebrews. Got that? All the descendants of Abraham are Hebrews. All the descendants of Jacob are Israelites. Okay? But only the descendants of Judah and Benjamin are Jews. The other 10 tribes are Ephraimites, sometimes called Israelites. And that's why for the rest of the Old Testament and most of the New, you hear about Ephraim and Judah, or Israel and Judah. Go read the prophecies of Isaiah and Ezekiel, and you will hear God say time and time again, "I'll have mercy on the house of Israel and the house of Judah. On the house of Ephraim and the house of Judah." He always sees a clear dividing line between the two. Because the northern tribes have the promise and the birthright, and the southern tribes have the promise of the Messiah to come. He could scatter the 10 northern tribes, and he has scattered them all over the world. Now remember, when you look for the northern tribes, they're not going to look Jewish. No sooner did they become the northern kingdom than they gave up their Judaism. They weren't following Judaistic rules and laws right from the start under Jeroboam. So don't expect them to be keeping the Sabbath. And don't look for them to be eating kosher. And they're not going to be keeping Passover. They gave all of that up as soon as they became a kingdom. Only the southern tribes, Judahites, the Jews, kept the Jewish religion going. You got all that? Because that's the answer to his question. So now, who are the people that are in Israel right now?
Jews.
So the Jews that lived there during the time of Christ, there has always been, clear on up through 500, 1,000, 1,500 there have been Jews living right
You
there.
Get it.
Just for a period of time, they weren't an actual nation.
Exactly right.
In 48, they were branded by the United Nations.
But the religion has always been maintained, has always been retained. Now, again, that's the problem with the Al Mills, is that they say at 70 AD the religion ended? No, it didn't. If somebody knocked down your church, would that ruin your religion? No, you can see historically, you can read.
Man, I lose
But you can see that in 100 AD, in 150 AD, in 200 AD, in 250 AD, you can read the Jews were always there, the religion was always alive. They just didn't have a temple to sacrifice in. But the religion has always maintained and maintains to this day. And it was the Jews that went back to Israel, who are the descendants of Judah, the Judahites.
You know, that's why, too, they have a theory that the northern tribes are so intermarried so many times that their complete identity is gone. The northern 10 tribes are us who the Lord calls out.
That's why they call them the lost tribes.
I mean, you don't agree with that, though, do you?
No, I don't agree necessarily that the lost tribes are us. No, I cannot replace the lost tribes with the church.
Okay.
But to say that just because men have lost track...
Doesn't mean God
lost track. That's why.
It wasn't a pure line, though. That's definitely.
It wasn't a pure line to begin with.
Well, that's true. Because
Ephraim was half Egyptian.
Who was it, the prophet when the spies went into?
Yes, absolutely. Rahab.
Yeah, Rahab. Yeah.
Rahab was.
Another one.
Yes. Rahab's right in the lineage of Jesus.
Well, I would say that Ephraim is the side that shows all the wars and everything else that goes on.
Absolutely.
And then the only thing true line you see is the Jews, so really.
Right.
You've got one from promise, one's not.
One's for the land promise, one's for the messianic promise.
Yeah.
And by the way, God scattered the northern tribes because he didn't need them for a while. Once the Messiah came, what did he do to the southern tribes? Scattered them too. Now what is the point of Ezekiel's two sticks when God came to Ezekiel and said, write on one of them the house of Ephraim and on the other the house of Judah? At the time Judah existed, Ephraim was gone to the four winds. And he said, put those two sticks together and go march into Judah. And when they ask you what that means, say, I am the representative of God. These are the two houses. I will unite them in my hand and bring them back to this land to dwell forever in safety. That's never happened. But it's a promise to Ezekiel that the scattered tribes of the north and the south will regather and come back in here. That's why the 1948 gathering of the Jews in Israel is not the fulfillment of the land promised to Abraham. It has to be fulfilled in Ephraim. And it can only happen when the tribes that are scattered all over the world who have forgotten their identity, who don't know who they are, after the church is gone... During the 7-year tribulation, 144,000 people who don't know their heritage are going to go, boot, I'm Zebulun. God's going to mark them out. Absolutely. You're mine, you're mine, you're mine. And then who are they supposed to go preach to? Their people. They go preach to their tribe, to their people. The church is gone. Pardon me?
As Satan labels his own, God will mark.
Yes, absolutely. You get that. Yes. God's mark will be on his own. And the devil's mark will be on his own, absolutely. Now, Judah and Israel, the northern and southern tribes then, historically, the northern tribes have disappeared. They haven't disappeared to God. He will bring them back into their land, and that will be the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise. I think it's interesting that God's dealings with Israel start with a promise to Abraham that won't be fulfilled to the end of time. That's how sovereign this God is. And as you see human history mapped out, and compare it to biblical history, you see God's hand at work controlling human history around his firstborn Israel. It's all about Israel. It's all about his firstborn. Human history is about Israel. He'll raise up kings and take down nations to control what happens to Israel. And he's doing it today. He's still doing it. He planted them over there in 1948 to start paving the way. Oh yeah, remember that land I promised to my people? Guess what? Here's the land, here come two of my tribes. I'll go get the rest of them and they'll all march in together. He's going to do it.
We're already there, is the thing that threw me off. I always got the impression, you know, the past 10 years when people say 1948.
That's when it became a nation.
To the land like there wasn't any there to start with.
But where did they, right, that's right. They came back and reclaimed the land that was theirs, but they were already there, but they came from Russia and they came from Poland and they came from America and they came from all these places and came back and reclaimed the land that was theirs to start with. Now, the only thing they're missing is a temple. So what's the deal Antichrist makes with them?
Build a temple.
Build a temple. That's exactly right.
It makes peace.
Isn't it amazing how the Bible all fits together? Ain't that amazing? Mm-hmm. Now, that was a long answer to your question, but do you see the answer now?
Yes.
Okay. Next week, here's what we'll do. We're going to look at circumcision in the Mosaic Law. It'll only take 5 minutes. Because it ain't in there. We'll look at the verses. We'll look at the verses, but I'm telling you, circumcision is not commanded in the Mosaic Law.